Well, hello and good morning. It is July 15th, 2020, and this is the Morning Bible Study. Well, I am coming to you today, and we are, as you know, past the great rebellion against David, and now we are looking at a slightly less great rebellion. We are looking at another rebellion. And so what we see is David has secured the throne back from his son Absalom, but he is still trying to secure the throne in a more permanent way. Because why? Because the man Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite, decided that he was going to lead a rebellion against David because of the events that we read about in chapter 19. So we're in chapter 20, verses 1 through, just 1 through the whole chapter. Read all of chapter 20. Yep. We're going to read all of chapter 20 and then go ahead and unpause your audio and we're going to dive right into the text. Okay, beginning in verse 1, a wicked man named Sheba, son of Bichri, a Benjamite, happened to be there. He blew a trumpet and said, "We have no share in David. We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man go home, O Israel." Okay, so what is this all about? Okay, remember, they were bringing David back. And all of the people, all of the Israelite tribes were basically saying, "Hey, the war's over. We need to bring King David back to Jerusalem." And David sends word to the Judeans, to the people of the tribe of Judah, and he says, "Hey, why should you be the last to talk about bringing back the king? I'm your own flesh and blood." And the people of Judah are like, "Oh yeah, good point." So they go, and they want to bring David back. Well, then a whole bunch of Benjamites go, and they want to cross him over. And the Benjamites are led, it's seemingly at least a large contingent of them, 1,000 men plus Shimei, they come out, and Shimei begs forgiveness for insulting the king and what he did, and the king grants him forgiveness, but the Judeans basically escort the king across while the other tribes are either still assembling or they're not quite there yet. Obviously, they're there, but they're not quite there. They're not ready. They didn't think that this crossing of the Jordan was going to be such an immediate activity. I guess it's hard to say exactly what was going on here. But whatever happened, there was this kind of ceremonial faux pas. And the Israelites are like, "Hey, Judah, why did you take the king across without us? Like, we were here and we wanted to cross over with the king too." And Judah's like, "Why are you getting mad? Like, the king's closely related to it." Basically, Judah says, "Look, the king's part of our tribe and we didn't do anything wrong. We're allowed to cross the Jordan with the king." And the Israelites say, "Yeah, but we have 10 shares in David. We have 10 shares in the kingship because there are 10 of us tribes and there's one tribe of David. And, you know, we have a right to cross over with the king too." And the Judeans say, "You know, why don't you say it to my face?" Well, they don't really say that literally. But what it says is the people of Judah then responded even more severely to those who were the men of Israel. That's how the Net Bible puts it. The NIV says, "But the men of Judah pressed their claims even more forcefully than the men of Israel." So it's a slightly different translation, but it's in that same vein. And the point is that, and I know we're back in chapter 19, and I know we're supposed to be talking about chapter 20 here, but it's important to cover this background information, because basically what happened is the Judeans said, "Hey, everybody, look at how close we are with David. David and Judah are besties." And Israel's like, "Hey, we also are related to David. We're also Israelites. We also care about the king. So, Judah, you should have waited for us." And Judah basically said, "Why don't you make me?" Okay, so it became very childish very quickly. And then that's when this guy named Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite, happened to be there, and he blows his trumpet, and he says, "You know, we have no share in David. We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man go home, O Israel, or every man to his tents." And so it's an idiom basically saying, "Look, David's a king of Judah. We ain't from Judah." Now, it is not an accident that this is a Benjamite. There's not an accident here, okay? It is significant that he's a Benjamite. Why? Well, remember what we just saw with yesterday, what we talked about with Mephibosheth? The Benjamite used to be the royal tribe. They are not the royal tribe now. Who insulted David? Shimei. Remember Shimei, the Benjamite? where was all this conflict about whether David had loyalty or not with Mephibosheth, a Benjamite, the son of Saul? And now who leads this rebellion, who wants to go and basically say David can be king of Judah, but we're going to get our own king? Who does this? A Benjamite. Okay, so Benjamin is quickly becoming this tribe where there's a lot of issues. And this has happened with Benjamin before, by the way. That's what you get with baby brothers, right? You know, that's the youngest kid is always the problem child. You know, we all know that. Everybody who's the oldest child, we all know, right? Like, everybody who's the oldest child, we know. We know that being the oldest necessarily makes you the best. It's just a fact. You're the best child. Your parents gave their best energy, their best efforts. They had no competition for their affection. They poured all their love into you. And if you are the firstborn child, you are, I can say confidently as a firstborn child, you are the child your parents love and like the best. Okay? I know parents always tell younger siblings, you know, it's not a competition. I love you all equally. All firstborn children know that's not true. Okay, that's just something that parents say to subsequent children from the firstborn. We all know firstborns are the favorite. Okay, so and so what we see from Benjamin is just the classic petulant, childish, babyish behavior of the youngest child. So I can't really say that with a straight face, but I am laughing, and I hope you're laughing too. Unless you're like the youngest child, and then you're probably, you know, listening to this, shaking your fist, saying, "Oh, that Luke, he's such a jerk. Of course he is. He's a firstborn." Okay, so the men of Israel deserted David, and they followed Sheba, the son of Bichri, but the men of Judah stuck by their king all the way from the Jordan River to Jerusalem. So David gets back to his palace, and the king took the 10 concubines, basically who slept with Absalom, and he put them under confinement, and he took care of them, but he didn't have sex with them, which is the right thing to do according to the law of Israel. And they remained in confinement until the day they died. By the way, remember, when Absalom did that, right, when he slept with his father's concubines, he was breaking the law of Israel. He was breaking God's law. A father and son should not sleep with the same woman. Law's very clear about that, right? And David is not going to break the law. David's like, "Hey, my son slept with these women, even though they were my concubines. I am not going to engage in this. That would be wrong." So he treats them like he would one of his other concubines, but he doesn't have sex with them. So, and then the king calls Amasa. Okay, remember who Amasa was? Amasa was Absalom's commander-in-chief, who is also a similar blood relation to Absalom that Joab was to David. And so he calls Amasa, and he said to Amasa that he was going to be the commander-in-chief. And he says, "Call the men of Judah together for me in 3 days, and you will be present with them too." And so Amasa went out to get Judah, but he took longer than the king had allotted him. So Amasa, remember, Amasa's a new commander-in-chief. He's a new commander of the army. And so it's taking him a while to get this stuff done. He's not ready to go right away. And he doesn't maybe necessarily command the loyalty of the troops. Remember, Amasa fought against them. Okay? So the fact that Amasa is now their commander-in-chief, maybe a lot of them are like, "Eh, I don't know that I trust this guy. You know, I'm not sure that I'm 100% with him. You know, maybe not hundo P, as the kids say. You know, so... they're not sure if they're ready to follow Amasa." So then David says to Abishai, notice Joab is being circumspectly ignored here. He says to Abishai, "Now Sheba, son of Bichri, will cause greater disaster for us than Absalom did. Take your Lord's servants and pursue him. Otherwise, he will secure fortified cities for himself and get away from us." So Joab's men, accompanied by the Kerethites, the Pelethites, and all the warriors, left Jerusalem to pursue Sheba, son of Bichri. Okay, so David gave a really short a time window to Amasa. Why? Because he wants to quench this. He wants to nip this in the bud. He does not want Sheba to go around and find some kind of sympathetic village or walled city where he can withstand a prolonged siege and then build an actual real rebellion. And so David sends Amasa out and says, I want the army gathered in 3 days, and then we're gonna start the hunt for Sheba." Okay? Which, incidentally, what does this remind us of, by the way? Maybe of David being persecuted by Saul? Remember how David had to flee from place to place and Saul wanted to hunt him like a partridge in the mountains? Well, what's happening? David is now doing this to another pretender to the throne. You know, Sheba thinks that he's going to be king. David thought he was going to be king. But here's the difference. David was not in active rebellion against Saul. Sheba is. And so now we see a hunt for a false king that is good. You know, so it's an interesting role reversal here. I'm not saying there's any moral component to it, really. I just think that it's an interesting role reversal. And one, incidentally, that after David did what he did, he has to continue to deal with threats to the throne. First his son Absalom, then Sheba, and then he's going to have problems with the inheritance, with handing off the crown. Okay, and so because Amasa takes so long, David's like, I can't wait on this. Okay, that's, we now have to take action. I gave Amasa a chance. He couldn't Amasa the troops. That's a little pun there for you. And he wasn't able to do it, so he sends out Abishai. Notice he does not send out Joab. And when they were all near the big rock that is in Gibeon, I don't know where the big rock in Gibeon is, but apparently there was a real big rock in Gibeon that was very well known because it was just the big rock. Amasa came to them. Now, Joab was dressed in his military attire and had a dagger in its sheath belted to his waist. And when he advanced, it fell out. Okay? It fell out is really interesting. Okay? When it says it fell out, the NIT or the NET says the significance of the statement it fell out here is unclear. If the dagger fell out of its sheath before Joab got to Amasa, how then did he kill him? Josephus Antiquities suggests that Joab approached Amasa. He deliberately caused the dagger to fall to the ground at an opportune moment, as though by accident. When he bent over and picked it up, he then stabbed Amasa with it. Others have tried to make the case for thinking that two swords are referred to, the one that fell out and another that Joab kept concealed until the last moment. But nothing in the text clearly supports this view. Perhaps Josephus' understanding is best, but it is by no means obvious in the text either. Okay, so basically we have this weird expression where it says, you know, that his dagger fell out, that it just fell. It was, it had slipped out. And so there's this question of what does that mean? Now, the general consensus among the commentators and the specialtators is basically that he let it drop to the ground. That you know, he was wearing this sheath that was too big for the sword or the dagger or the dirk, whatever term we want to use, and he let it drop and fall on the ground, and so he just bent over, picked it up, like, oh, this was such a strange accident, and went over, and the guy wasn't concerned about the sword or the dagger in his hand. I mean, possibly, but I guess because that's never the way I've imagined it, I've always thought it was differently. I've always thought just the expression "it dropped out of its sheath" meant that he had a thing in a very loose sheath, and it was on his waist, which means that it was horizontal. And so all he did was he just, like, and this is kind of what Matthew Henry alludes to. He had an overbig sheath, and he had it sitting on his waist, so that all he had to do was kind of shake it a little bit, and it would fall into his hand. So he didn't have to make a clear drawing movement. He just had to kind of, like, move a little bit, and then the knife would fall into his hand. And so to me, that makes a lot of sense. Because if he has this strapped on his waist, and he has it sideways, so that it will just slide out of the sheath if he moves the right way, and he reaches in and grabs Amasa's beard with his right hand to kiss him, if he's going to do that, he's going to turn his body a little bit, and maybe then the knife just slides out into his hand, and he's able to kill him. That's how I've always imagined it. But you know what? We don't really know. It could be a lot of different things. And so, you know, maybe he did let it fall to the ground, but the thing is that it doesn't say that it fell to the ground. There's just not a lot of clarity here. Okay, so that's in the end. There's just not a lot of clarity. And so we just know that he killed him. Okay, so he says, you know, how are you, my brother? With his right hand, he took a hold of Amasa's beard, which, by the way, never touch a man's beard to betray him. That's just high treason, I think. And Amasa didn't protect himself from the knife in his left hand, and Joab stabbed him in the abdomen, causing Amasa's intestines to spill to the ground. There was no need to stab him again. The blow was fatal. Then Joab and his brother Abishai pursued Sheba, the son of Bichri. Okay? So, and then, this is interesting, Then one of Joab's soldiers who stood over Amasa. So, like, this one guy just walks by. He was one of Joab's men. And he walks by Amasa and he goes, whoever's for Joab and whoever's for David, follow Joab. So Amasa, this is pretty grotesque here. It says Amasa was squirming in his own blood in the middle of the path. And this man had noticed that all the other soldiers had stopped. Having noticed that everyone who came across Amasa stopped, the man pulled him out of the path and into the field and threw a garment over him. Once he had removed Amasa from the path, everyone followed Joab to pursue Sheba, son of Bichri. Okay, so this is pretty grotesque. I mean, this is Joab and Amasa are family. And again, Joab always just stays barely within the law, right? He kills Amasa. Now, does he kill Amasa because Amasa rebelled against the king, or does he kill Amasa because he was trying to take Joab's position as commander in chief? Really hard to say. Really, really hard to say. Joab just always stays just barely within the law. Just by the skin of his teeth, he stays within the law. And so David really can't do anything to Joab. And also, Joab and Abishai together command such immense loyalty within the army that there really was, David has said over and over and over, he goes, what can I do about these sons of Zeruiah, or Zeruiah, however you want to pronounce that. And he says, I'm stuck. Because I need them, and everyone is so loyal to them. I'm the king, but I am not strong enough to handle these men. And I think we're going to pause today, because we've already gone so long, and we're gonna finish up chapter 20 tomorrow. But just some things to think about here, okay? Some things to think about. Even if Joab did the right thing, he did it in the wrong way. And everyone who passed by, this harkens back to what happened when Asahel died. When Asahel died, fighting against Abner, son of Ner, that's Joab's brother and Abishai's brother, everyone who saw the body stopped and paused because they realized that something big had happened. The same thing happened here. These guys are going off to war and they see one of their own men, their own commander, has been stabbed in the gut and he's writhing around in his blood, dying a slow, painful death. And they stop and they're like, what should we do? And then one of the guys is like, whoever's for Joab and whoever's for David, follow Joab. And he just pulls him off the road. I mean, you know, out of sight, out of mind. And again, we get another insight into who Joab is. We get another insight into who Joab is. And we see, again, David is still not in control of his kingdom. He is not even close to in control of his kingdom. He is still paying the price for his sin. He is still being a passive participant in his own life. And that is a terrible place to be. We are continuing to see, even though the rebellion against Absalom is over, we are still continuing to see the high, high cost of sin. Anyways, we will finish up the story about Sheba tomorrow, and I hope you'll join us then. Thank you. God bless.